Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough, and today we are talking about the numerous retirements from the Utah State Legislature, the numerous Republican suitors hoping to woo voters away from Mitt Romney, the continuing frustration from Salt Lake City leaders over the inland port deal, and how the national walkout to protest gun violence played out here in Utah. Joining me to talk about these stories, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson. Welcome, Lee.
Hi, good morning.
Education reporter Ben Wood. Good morning and welcome to you, Ben.
Good morning. Thank you.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks for being here as well, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
As always, you can join this conversation. Call us with your questions and comments. We are at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Or you can post your questions and comments to sltrib.com. Let's lead today with news that was made by kids, by adolescents, Ben Wood. A walkout on Wednesday coinciding with the national school walkout to mark 1 month since the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. You were out visiting schools and hearing from students. Can you sort of paint a picture for us? What did the students have to say about what this action meant to them and why they were doing it?
Yeah, you know, we heard a lot of different reasons, everything from students who are very supportive of stricter gun control measures and gun ownership rules, other students who simply felt it was important to pay tribute to their fellow students in Florida whose lives had been lost. Right. So a lot of different motivations, but kind of all coming together in this solemn, you know, tribute that lasted for 17 minutes on Wednesday.
17 minutes, and then it was just, you know, back to class, I guess?
For most, you know, some students, you know, we've been chasing reports of students who just decided to bail on school for the rest of the day. But for the most part, yeah, they went outside. They, you know, depending on the individual location, they went outside. They just kind of stood in silence for some time, perhaps some remarks shared, some comments, and then headed back into class.
Those kids who took off were just extra committed to the cause,
right,
I think, right?
That's what they're telling their teachers, of course. You kind of hinted at this already, Ben, but was this an overtly political statement, or did it just depend on the student? I'm guessing that some people were there to simply, as you said, memorialize, commemorate those who had fallen, the victims of the school shooting. But others were definitely making a political statement, right?
For sure, and especially the organizers, because most of these were put together on the ground by students individually. And so the kids who kind of led the way at their schools, they tended to be more politically oriented. And then as far as their classmates, they had a lot of different reasons for joining in.
Okay. There was some activism, though. I mean, a number of Utah lawmakers said that they were getting calls from students. I saw this in the Tribune just yesterday that you know, students are asking for conversations with lawmakers.
Yeah, conversations, potentially legislation. Susan Pulsifer has announced she's going to run a bill to commission a study on mass violence. You know, we still have the march next Saturday on the Capitol, and then a month from now, there's other walkouts planned. So there is this group of students nationally and here locally that are, you know, beating this drum and looking to get something going.
Robert Gerke, news columnist, do you want to comment on just the action, the activism by students, I guess, that's taking place or has been taking place both here in Utah and around the country?
Well, I mean, we've been having this discussion or avoiding this discussion, I guess, for years now. And so for the students to be bringing attention to it and shining a light on this and sort of spurring moving the discussion forward, I think is valuable. As Ben mentioned, Representative Pulsifer is going to be sponsoring legislation. There was also an announcement from Kurt Bramble, Senator Bramble, and Representative Steve Ellison that they're going to, and a group of other legislators, that they want to have listening sessions where they just meet, where they're not, you know, combating, you know, it's just they sit and listen to these students talk about what they're concerned about. I think it's valuable. And I think what ultimately is going to be most valuable, my daughter goes to Olympus High School, and we were talking about the walkout recently, and they need to register these kids to vote, because a lot of these high school students especially are 17, 18 years old. They're going to be eligible to vote come November, and they need to do more than just walk out, right? They need to get registered, get involved, work on campaigns, get to the polling places and make their voice heard that way. But I mean, I think staying involved, and I think the sense of activism that was sort of sparked by the students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School after the shooting has spread all across the country.
All right. So today, and Robert Gerke's advice is take your activism to the polls. Ben Wood, during the legislative session that ended just a week ago, there was also activism going on from students, and that may have even propelled some bills, some initiatives that were related to, well, bills actually, that were related to guns and violence and school violence. Did those get traction?
They did not, and you know, a lot of that came late in the session, which, you know, again, there's a lot of talk we could have there, but there was a group of students who were regularly up at the Hill meeting with lawmakers, you know, asking for meetings. A commission was formed to look at school safety and gun safety issues over the summer. We're still waiting to hear exactly what will come out of that group. But then there were bills sponsored late in the session that didn't really make a lot of movement.
It was kind of frustrating because Representative Steve Handy had a bill that would have these red flag laws that other states have enacted, Connecticut being the first.
And describe what those are just really quickly. Robert.
Yeah, it's where somebody who is believed to be mentally ill, either a threat to themselves or to others, and is known to have guns, certain people, family members, loved ones, can go to a court, get an order to have the guns taken away from that person. Connecticut's had one of these for years, and they think it saves lives. They think it saved up to 75 lives since they've had it in place. Because this isn't about people going in, you know, trying to prevent mass shootings necessarily. This is about trying to prevent suicides. Because in Utah, at least, 87% of gun deaths are a result of suicide. And so if you can take the, you know, somebody who's in crisis and restrict their access to the gun in some way. Now, it's not foolproof, right? They can go somewhere else, borrow a gun, steal a gun. You know, there are ways around it, but it's been shown to be effective, and the legislature killed that bill pretty unceremoniously. The argument that, well, we don't have time to do this in the session, I think is kind of ridiculous, because we had the Las Vegas shooting last year, we had the Orlando shooting, we had the, you know, going back years, I mean, going back to Newtown, and, you know, all of these shootings that we've had, and there's not been any action. In fact, I think the only bill that got much traction up there at all was strengthening our stand your ground law, which wasn't weak in the first place, but, you know, that they wanted to make it stronger. So, you know, this is going to be an ongoing discussion. I think there is some urgency. I think that we might even see a special session on this sometime later in the year, rather than wait till, you know, next January. And to give the legislature some credit, they did do some things on suicide prevention. And as I mentioned, you know, guns and suicide, there's a direct linkage there. Stevie Listen, for the last several years, has been pushing legislation and pushing funding for trigger locks, which are a pretty valuable tool in trying to keep guns out of the hands, especially out of the hands of children and children who might. And the reason that's important is because suicide is the leading cause of death for children between the ages of 10 and 17, and guns are the leading instrument used in those suicides.
Right. I want to remind listeners that you can join this conversation with your questions, your comments at 801-355-8255, or you can go to sltrib.com and make your comment there. You know, after the shooting in Florida, House Speaker Greg Hughes said that something had to be done about school shootings, and it seemed like there was momentum at the legislature. But in the end, I mean, as we've just talked about, that just fizzled, I guess, in the end, Ben Wood.
It did. And, you know, it's, as Greg said, it's complicated to look at what the legislature does and parse exactly what happened. I mean, we've talked a lot about the Our Schools Now compromise. That bill didn't exist until the last day of the session. So time is a very loose construct at the legislature. But yes, Speaker Hughes, he came out strong saying we need to do something now. That bill hit committee with a thud and died right there. But as Gerke said, there is this this conversation happening about a special session, maybe looking what this commission recommends and trying to get some of that agreement taken care of ahead of time so that if there is a special session, they could push something through.
How have Utah leaders, Utah state lawmakers, come down on the concept that has been floated by, for example, the president to arm teachers? Ben, you are an education reporter. You went and covered these student activism. You know, I guess we could talk about what the students themselves say about arming teachers as well. I don't know if this is something that that our politicians have weighed in on much.
They did right after it was first said, and that was kind of the last we heard of it. I mean, as I'd like to remind people, when we talk about arming teachers, that means everything from allowing gun owners who are teachers to bring their guns to school to, you know, mandatory armament on the other side of the spectrum. Utah already allows concealed carry permit holders to bring their guns onto school campuses. So in a way, we already have armed our teachers for those who care to be armed. The president has spoken further about training and incentives and some funding, you know, perhaps to put more guns in the hands of teachers. That's still very nebulous right now, and it didn't seem like local lawmakers had really seized on that yet.
And locally, a lot of the concealed carry permit instructors have discounts or free classes for Utah teachers. I don't think we've had an example where a gun in a classroom has deterred an attack. I mean, I guess it's hard to prove that there maybe wasn't an attack.
It deterred a toilet once a few years ago.
That's what I was going to say. I think 3 years ago, a teacher blew a toilet apart with her gun, and I think it maybe nicked her own leg, but it was, you know, and we saw another case like that, and I think that was California this week. But if you go to sltrib.com, there was, I think last weekend, there was a story about another series of classes for teachers who want to get their concealed carry permit and carry in classrooms.
As far as the sort of initial conversation we were having here goes, Robert Gierke, there's this common cycle. You know, you wrote about this just after the shooting in Florida, that we see a lot of action, a lot of momentum, then it fades, and then we wait for the next tragedy, and the momentum builds again and then kind of deflates. And I'm wondering if our looking away from it is kind of a defense mechanism in the end to sort of not have to think about it. But are we getting out of that orbit, escaping that gravity a little bit here, Robert, with what's happened in Florida and the student activism that's happened as a result?
I think it could be a defense mechanism in some respects, but I also think it's a strategy by the gun rights groups, the NRA and others, to try to, you know, ride it out and you know, push back on any, you know, on anything that, because I mean, if you think about after Las Vegas, there was almost universal support for banning bump stocks, and we still haven't seen that. And we've seen, you know, the president said he's going to instruct the Justice Department to take action administratively to pursue that. But we haven't seen Congress act on anything after any shooting, it feels like. And so I to be fair, the House did pass a bill, I believe it was on Tuesday, it might have been Wednesday, right, that did have some mental health, you know, had, I think, $500 million in grants for schools to sort of coordinate better with local law enforcement. We'll see where that goes. But again, the issue of guns is nobody seems willing to have that discussion. And so, yeah, I mean, we'll see if this fades. I mean, I think based on the history, that's sort of the pattern that we fall into. And I have to think that we'll fall into that same pattern this time.
Ben Wood, as you said, the student activism isn't stopping with the walkout that took place on Wednesday. There's more planned, the March for Our Lives event on the 24th. Just circling back for 1 second to that activism, the event or the walkout that took place on Wednesday, there was a component of it that was walk up versus walk out. Can you talk about that for a second, what that sort of suggestion was, who made it, and what it was meant to do?
Yeah, that was an effort by the schools themselves to kind of incorporate the mood into a learning experience. I mean, you know, teachers are always trying to teach people things. because the schools themselves were in a bit of a delicate position because they had to remain quite neutral on these walkouts, but you know, they also couldn't ignore that they were happening. So you saw a lot of administrators doing this walk-up idea where either in contrast or in addition to the walkouts, they were asking their students to make a point to reach out to isolated students, make new friendships, introduce themselves to people they hadn't yet introduced themselves to, just kind of as a general friendship and kindness effort.
Okay. You know, guys, we should probably turn to a break here and come back and tackle some other topics from this past week's news. But really interesting coverage at the Salt Lake Tribune's website. Really interesting photos, as a matter of fact, of the walkouts from the various schools. And you can check those out at sltrib.com. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. There's more to come, including a mass exodus from the legislature, Representative Chris Stewart's critique of American intelligence agencies, and more. That's coming up just ahead on Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Behind the headlines, I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson, education reporter Benjamin Wood, and columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning local news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by posting them at sltrib.com or calling 801-355-8255. That's the number to call, 801-355-TALK. Lee Davidson, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter, let's turn to you now because you were there when some guy called Mitt Romney made it official and filed here in Utah to run for the U.S. Senate yesterday. But he is not alone. How many people altogether are running for that Senate seat, Lee Davidson?
Well, 19 people are running, including him. So he has 18 opponents. So he didn't exactly scare people away. But most of these people you've never heard of, with the exception of the top Democrat running at Salt Lake County Council member Jenny Wilson.
Right.
She's well-known, obviously. Among Republicans running against him, probably the best-known in the pack is Mike Kennedy. He's a current state representative from Alpine. Interestingly, he's both a medical doctor and a lawyer. And his name brings back memories probably for Romney. The last time he ran for Senate against a Kennedy, it was Ted Kennedy in Massachusetts, and it was a rather bitter campaign that Kennedy won.
Hmm. Okay, so the best known is Kennedy, but the are all of these people who are running against Romney, they must be singling him out as the one to beat. One candidate told you that it was a classic David and Goliath story, Lee, and there was apparently a casting call for David extras because there were a lot. Again, this is a lot of people to go against a very well-known Mitt Romney and expect a chance.
Right. And most of them make the same argument. They like to argue that Romney is essentially a carpetbagger from Massachusetts. And, gee, they're all from Utah, and they know Utah values, and, you know, so he liked me. Romney, when he filed, said, you know, the water's fine, come on in. You know, this is a great American tradition. People like to spout off and run for office, and so we'll all have a good time together on the trail.
Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, there's a colorful bunch. Most of these folks are running for the first time, but not all.
Yeah.
Jeremy Friedbaum, I think is his name, once ran against
Chris Cannon
when he was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. Cannon had spent a bundle of money. Friedbaum spent $500 and managed to take Cannon into a primary, force him into a primary. So he's hoping, you know, for similar success without a lot of money. He's a piano technician. He says he gets grand pianos ready for concert. You know, he's not a real politician, exactly.
Well, there's a lot of not real politicians who are now politicians.
And I should have mentioned that there is one candidate you probably heard of, Abe Lincoln, Brian Jenkins. His photo when he filed, you know, he's a Abe Lincoln lookalike. So you can look at that in our story.
Yeah, check it out at sltrib.com. It's kind of amazing. I mean, is his legal name Abe Lincoln Brian Jenkins?
That is how he's going to appear on the ballot, so I guess it is.
Okay, so
I don't think you have to appear under your legal name on the ballot.
Okay.
You appear basically however you want your name.
Didn't Superdell have Superdell on
it
the ballot
Super
once?
Superdell, oh, Shanzi,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we may need to look at that, I think. Because if I was running, I'd put Mitt Romney down, and then I could actually make
Ronald Reagan.
Win, right?
Mitt Romney II, or
yeah.
the better Mitt Romney.
The better Mitt Romney. Mitt
Romneyer. Actually, Robert Gerke, just while I've got you on the mic here, how does a candidate, you know, in a crowded field like this distinguish themselves when there's a kind of heir apparent, or an apparent heir apparent, in the form of Mitt Romney? You know, other than, of course, naming yourself Abe Lincoln.
Yeah, I don't see any way you really can. I mean, I think, you know, Jenny Wilson is having a difficult time with this, too, getting traction, getting attention, getting media attention. You know, Mitt sucks a lot of the oxygen out of the room, and everybody else kind of has to, you know, stand back and take shots at him. It's sort of like in the, you know, their Lilliputians, I guess, in Gulliver's Travels. There's a literary reference for your morning. it's really difficult to take down the 800-pound gorilla.
How about for a Mike Kennedy? I mean, is that something that he could, is there a way, you know, do you see a path for him?
So here's the path for Kennedy is that he's somewhat more well-known, slightly more well-known, although I always still get him mixed up with Representative Christofferson. He's got some money. What I've heard is that he's planning to put some of his own money into the race, which will be helpful. And, you know, we've still got this convention system in place, and that gives people who are lesser known an opportunity to make some waves. You know, I think Mitt Romney may not be terribly popular at the convention, although we have to wait and see what the delegate pool that's selected at the caucuses is. It looks like. I think there's an opportunity, a narrow window there for somebody like a Michael Kennedy to make a splash at the convention, to get on the primary ballot, and we'll see what happens then.
Lee Davidson, does this speak to there's a divide, a noted divide in the Republican Party over the rules related to the convention system, the caucus convention system. The fact that Romney, as Gerke says, might not have the easiest convention route addresses that divide in the Republican Party.
Well, I think he will probably do better than we think in the convention. He's been organizing, trying to get people to go to caucus meetings Tuesday night to run as his delegates. He's been running around the state meeting with people who've been delegates previously. I think he'll do okay.
And I will say this for Romney. I kind of thought he might file and then just sort of, you know, we wouldn't see him again until November, right? Because he arguably doesn't really have to campaign. He's been out there on the road, and if you follow his social media accounts, they're just bombarding you with pictures of him meeting with businesses, meeting with farmers, meeting with people all over the state. 4,000 miles, he said, he's traveled since he filed for the election.
Yeah, he's hit 20 out of 29 counties.
Yeah,
so far,
he's not doing this halfway. So he may not be from Utah, but he's seeing a lot of it in the last few weeks.
And he was trying to fight the carpetbagger image. He said yesterday that as I travel around the country, people always assume I'm from Utah. My whole career, even before he became a big name, said his parents were raised here, even though his dad was governor of Michigan and Mitt was raised in Michigan. Said he's lived here 10 years, his oldest son was born here, et cetera. So he's trying to show that he knows Utah.
Listeners, we want to hear your thoughts on this race. 801-355-8255 is the number to call. That's 801-355-TALK. Let's turn for a second to Jenny Wilson, who's a Democrat and is not by a long shot the only Democrat who's running. Does she, again, the sort of common narrative here is that it's a long shot for her to beat Mitt Romney. But is there a pathway for her, Robert Gerke?
Well, I think when she got into the race, she was hoping that Orrin Hatch would be her opponent, and that would be a maybe more conceivable path for her. I think it's difficult. I think the polling has shown that she is behind by, Lee, is it 45%?
It's a
very large margin, because Mitt is polling, not according to our poll, he's polling unaffiliated and even some Democratic voters over as well. It makes it really hard, and it makes it, you're already, when a Democrat gets into a statewide race, the last Democrat to win a statewide race was Jan Graham, who was our attorney general, I believe, in 96, or maybe it was 92 was the last one she won. It's an uphill battle, and it got a lot steeper with Mitt Romney in there. She's gonna keep fighting, I guess, but it's unlikely that we'll see her pull this upset. But we saw yesterday Buffalo knocked off Arizona in the NCAA tournament, so maybe there's a chance.
Busted brackets. Lee, there are a lot of other Democrats though who have filed for this race.
I can't remember the exact number, but I think there's four others besides her. Well known.
Yeah. The legislative session ended, as we said last week, and a number of lawmakers say that they won't be running for reelection. 21 state lawmakers in total, if I'm not mistaken, so far have announced that they're not going to be returning to the Utah legislature. Who are the sort of big names here? And maybe this is a question for either Lee or Ben Wood. Those people who are, maybe the most significant leaders who are not coming back next year.
Well, the two top leaders, right. Yeah. The two top leaders in the legislature are not coming back. Greg Hughes, the House Speaker, announced before the session that he wouldn't seek reelection. Wayne Niederhauser, the Senate President, announced this week that he won't. He had an interesting announcement. He said that he'd started having second thoughts. He had planned on running. And then he wrote down all the pros and cons, and all of the pros far outnumbered the cons. But then he said, a little voice in his head said, that's why you shouldn't run again. And he said, once you start thinking you're indispensable, you should go. And apparently he was starting to think that way, and so he left.
Doubting himself, I mean, or questioning his...
He's saying essentially it was going to his head, okay. So it's time to leave. Huh. He had already said that he would not run for his Senate president position again. There have been past presidents who decided to step down and still serve. Lyle Hilliard was a Senate president years and years ago, still in the Senate. But he just decided to leave. And interestingly, a couple of years ago, he wrote an op-ed piece saying the first time he ran, he went negative. And he put out negative, misleading information about the Democrat he was running against named Trish Beck. And he was apologizing much after the fact. And he was telling others, don't do what I did. You'll feel bad about it. And he said he wished he could take it back. So... he has some conscience there that
is there another political future there for Senate President Wayne Niederhauser? I mean, is he eyeing a future or a different seat? I guess the reason I ask that is because it seems that, or we suspect that Speaker Greg Hughes is going to run for governor. Is there something like that for Wayne Niederhauser?
Short answer is I don't know, but I don't think so.
Gerkey?
I mean, it's possible, but he hasn't made any suggestions that he had ever had interest in higher office, and so, and he's doing pretty well here. But who knows? It's hard to say. He doesn't have sort of the obvious ambition that Greg Hughes has, you know, where there's every time there's an open seat in Congress or at the state level, his is one of the names that gets thrown out there.
Have we ever had this many lawmakers announce that they're leaving at once? I mean, this is a full fifth of the state legislature retiring.
I can't think of a time that there's been this kind of turnover. It's pretty shocking. And some of the and not only, you know, the number of people who are leaving, I think it's also interesting. You've got some people who've been up there a long, long time, people like Pete Knudsen and Howard Stevenson, both of them, I think, between the two of them, probably have 50, 60 years of service up there. And so, you know, you're losing some institutional knowledge there. And then you've got over on the House side, you've got some of the younger people, guys like Justin Fossen and Jeremy Peterson, who are leaving. And, you know, so Mike Noel is a big name that was leaving. He's the House Rules Chairman, a sort of a lightning rod kind of politician, bomb thrower against the wilderness groups and so forth. So, there's some movers and shakers and maybe the upside of this is you have this many people who are leaving. It creates openings for other younger representatives and for a new generation of leader to come step forward.
This is obviously a question for you, Robert, again, as a columnist who can opine on these things. But does any of this have to do with, you know, national politics? Are prominent Republicans stepping out of the public eye because they don't want their, I don't know, their boats tied to the rough waters of the USS Trump? I mean, is that part of this?
Nobody I've heard has said that that's the case, so I don't think I think it's a when you have that broad of a field that's leaving, I think it's probably maybe a little bit of a generalization. Perhaps there's some people who don't like the tone of politics in the country, but I mean, at the state level, it hasn't seemed to be that much rougher than in previous years. So I would kind of doubt that that's a major factor.
Any sort of worry about brain drain at the legislature, about people? I guess
Well, they only have one brain to begin with. So, no, I'm kidding. I'm joking. I think there is some concern about that because, you've got a guy like Kevin Van Tassel, who was the vice chair of the Appropriations Committee, leaving. Howard Stevenson, as I mentioned, a couple decades pushing education issues, and Ben can talk more about the type of education issues he pushed, but he was a very polarizing figure in that regard. Even a guy like Greg Hughes, who's been up there for a long time, but has been very involved in transportation and transit issues, has a lot of knowledge on those issues. I think it does create some brain drain, and You know, but again, it's also an opportunity for younger people and new ideas to kind of come to the surface, I think.
How about the status of the legislature as a part-time yearly lawmaking body? There's constantly talk about trying to make it a full-time session because of the fact that lawmakers already say that it's taking all of their time as it is. And is that part of the reason maybe that some of these lawmakers are leaving? Will this bring that argument back to the fore?
Well, I mean, a lot of them are, in fact, leaving because of other opportunities or other career opportunities. I think Justin Fossen said he's moving out of state because he's and has other opportunities there. Some of them, like Peter Knudsen, just got old. But, you know, I think you've already got a dynamic where it does take up so much time. I think normal people have a hard time getting 45 days a year off to go serve in the legislature.
Sure.
So you do have this phenomenon where everybody who serves up there is generally fairly above average wealth anyway, or else they're retired, you know, and don't have to worry about working. So I think that's why there's been some resistance to making it to extending the session or, you know, making it a full-time legislature.
Finally, just before we head to a break, Lee Davidson, can we talk about what's going to happen to these leadership positions? I mean, with the Senate president leaving, House Speaker leaving, who is sort of tapped or anointed? Who are the people who are going to fill these roles most likely?
Well, we'll see over coming months, but in the House, you would expect that House Majority Leader
Brian Wilson. I love the Beach Boys, but it was a different
musical
guy.
Genius.
Anyway, it shows you how sharp I am. You
know, we can like get him out of bed. He's going to move up to it. Sorry.
You know, anyway, that would be the expected move. Over in the Senate, it's a little weird because the majority leader, Ralph Okerlund, is in frail health. He's hoping for a heart transplant. He would not be expected to move up. Stuart Adams has said he's the current whip, has said he's interested in running for president, so he's one who would. I don't know who else may. I've heard some names like Wayne Harper, but I don't know.
I think Senator Kurt Bramble is one that I've heard quite a bit. And, you know, there's sort of an outside chance there's a group of people who are pushing for Deidre Henderson to make a run for that spot, which would be remarkable. She'd be the first female Senate president, and so there would be some buzz around that, I think. Although she did run for a leadership spot last year and was beaten by Knudsen, so it may be a long shot.
Ben Wood, any different take on this? You've been following the legislative session. That's why I asked you. Do you predict anything different than these guys are predicting?
No, everything they're saying is right. One other thing to watch out for, though, is there's the main leadership post, but then there's a number of lesser leadership positions that are interesting.
Sure.
Representative Noel was the rules chair in the House, a very powerful position. That's now open for grabs, and so it'll be interesting to see who takes that position in the House if Deirdre Henderson were to become Senate President. She's the current rules chair there, and so we could see a lot of dynamics changing even beyond the Speaker and President positions.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing to watch for, I mean, yeah, there's 20, I mean, the 21 retirements means there's 21 open seats, and those open seats tend to be a little bit more competitive than a seat where an incumbent is running. Incumbents almost always win. So, and you've seen some instances where people like LeVar Christensen have been in the House, want to run for the Senate. Keith Grover is running for the Senate against Senator Margaret Dayton. And so there is a possibility that not only are we going to see a whole bunch of new faces, we're going to see some turnover and some churn in some of these seats. I mean, we've talked about the blue wave, the Democratic wave. Is this going to be a wave election in this state? Hard to say, but when you have that many open seats, it does increase the potential that there is going to be some gains by the Democrats in the body. Going to be hard for them to actually lose ground, but they could maybe gain some ground in 2018.
Pick up some ground just because of the lack of that incumbent advantage. One person we haven't talked about is, as you said, Mike Noel is retiring. Phil Lyman, former San Juan County, or no, is he still San Juan County Commissioner?
He's still
San Juan County Commissioner, is running for that seat, for Mike Noel's seat, and that should make for an interesting race. Does he have a competitor? I think, Lee, you said he did.
He has two of them, an unaffiliated candidate and another Republican. The other Republican's name is... boy, I lost it again. I'm doing well here with names today. Kelly Stoll.
Okay.
He's the son of a former state senator, Dennis Stoll.
Dennis Stoll. Yeah, Kelly has been involved in sort of the the Chamber of Commerce tourism community down there in southeastern Utah. Good guy, young kid.
He's from Kanab.
Yeah, he's from Kanab. But yeah, he's Dennis Stoll's son, and that's interesting. I didn't realize he was running. One thing about Phil, I think Phil saw the writing on the wall, and with this, there was a court case where the San Juan County was ordered to redraw their county commission seats, and it was pretty unlikely that Phil was going to be able to win re-election with a much larger Navajo population in his county commission district. So when this seat came open, it made a lot of sense for him to take that leap.
Guys, we got to take a break, but when we come back, I want to turn to another thing that happened at the legislative session this year, which is the Inland Port Authority in Salt Lake City's Northwest Quadrant, the state designating that, I guess. We'll talk about that when we come back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. 2-minute break, and then we'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Lee Davidson, Benjamin Wood, and Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255, or you can go to sltrib.com and make your comments and questions there. Post them there, that is. As I mentioned, there was one thing that happened at the legislative session this year. This is the state establishing an inland port authority in Salt Lake City's Northwest Quadrant. And we talked a little bit about this on the show last week. It's 20,000 acres of land west of the airport. The city, Salt Lake City, had an inland port authority plan already in the works, but the area was, I believe, a little bit smaller. And there were protections in place for environmental considerations. This bill by Layton Republican Senator Jerry Stevenson came out in something like the last 10 days of the session. The city seems to have been caught off guard a little bit, and so they started negotiating, and the bill changed a bit. But when the final version of the bill came out, it didn't have some of the items that the city had agreed to. What it does is give 100% of the tax increment to the authority, none of that to the city. And in addition to that, there's more to this. The Salt Lake City mayor doesn't have any representation on the board. There is a spot for a city council member whose district it's in, and also a representative from the airport. I'm not certain who to throw this to. Maybe Robert Gerke. Greg Hughes says he passed the bill in frustration with the city, that the city was just going to run out the clock, and that nothing would be accomplished as a result. And so they forced this through. The city, of course, has been unhappy about this.
Yeah, the city's been trying to get the governor to veto it. The governor the governor's Office of Economic Development came out with a statement yesterday that said he intends to sign it and that it'll be good for Utah. The inland port, there seems to be a consensus that this port idea in the Northwest Quadrant is a good idea, and sort of a big opportunity to develop that relatively undeveloped section of land. There's opposition from environmental groups who are worried about wetlands and birds and things like that, and those, you know, they are legitimate concerns. But the big opposition is coming from the city, that is, they're losing their taxing authority, they're losing their zoning authority on this 20,000 acre chunk. I mean, this is a huge chunk of land. If you compare it to like the prison development, that's about 700 acres.
Yeah.
This is 20,000 acres. It slops into Magna, it slops into West Valley, and so they said it's a third of all their taxable land in the city, and so it's a big deal. And the bill, they worked for weeks trying to negotiate this to sort of get rid of some of the things that were more objectionable. The Senate passed a bill that I think the city would probably have been okay with, or at least more or less opposed to. It came back from the House in a very different format, and then the Senate went ahead and went along with the House at the last minute, or the last day or two, sure, or so of the legislature. So there's going to be some opposition, there continued opposition to this. But for the city, unfortunately, I mean, they're kind of stuck with it, because the way the state constitution and the state laws are crafted, the cities are subordinate to the state, and the state can pretty much do whatever it wants with the city. And that's what we're seeing here. We've had these sorts of development zones in the past. MIDA up in northern Utah, again, the Draper development area, the Prada area. But in those cases, the city's always were willing partners in the in this development idea. And in this case, it's sort of being foisted upon the city. And there's some, you know, there's some real opposition to it from the city at the city level.
Why is this happening right now? I mean, I guess the state wanted to take control. Would the city have had control if the state had not acted on this during the state legislative session?
The city's been sort of moving through the process of, you know, zoning this area, scoping this area, trying to, you know, in sort of with this idea of an inland port in a northwest quadrant. And so they've kind of been moving in that direction. I think this from what we heard from the state leaders, from Senator Stevenson and from Representative Gibson, who were sort of the two main players in this, they think it's too big of a lift for the city to do on its own. So they want to bring the state in. I mean, I think this is my opinion now as an opinion columnist. I think what it is they think they see it as a big project and they want to have their hands in it because, you know, it kills them to not have the control over it.
Well, and it takes the what they've done is it takes the sort of tax. How's the way to say this? The tax.
Increment
away from the city and puts it into the authority. I mean, it gives all the benefit to this authority that they're creating and takes it away from the city.
I mean, this is going to be a remarkably, it basically creates a city in itself, a 20,000 acre city on the west side of Salt Lake City where they're going to be doing their own thing. And, you know, and then the city also has to provide utilities, roads, that sort of thing to it without getting any of the revenue from it. So I think what we'll ultimately end up seeing here is this bill, the governor will sign this bill and he'll probably issue some, you know, sort of diplomatic statement where he says, Representative Gibson and Senator Stevenson and I are committing to working through some of these issues in the coming year because this is a 20, 25 year project. This is not a, you know, 16 month project. So there's going to be some time to sort of refine this. But again, the city's at a distinct disadvantage in trying to negotiate with the state because they have no leverage.
Well, and there are apparently negotiations going on. I know that Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Viscupski met with the governor. One of the concerns from the city is that they had, as I said at the outset of this, environmental protections in place. As you mentioned, Robert, mm-hmm. there's sensitive wetlands out there. Mm-hmm. And they say essentially that the state isn't taking that into consideration. There's also some language in the bill referring to the storage and transportation of natural resources through this inland port, saying essentially that can't be banned.
Well, I think you remember we talked about the Oakland port before, and the state and Utah wanted to move Utah coal through the Oakland port, and the city of Oakland shut down roads, you know, prohibited shipping coal along the roads to and from the port. And so I think that's what that language is meant to, intended to try to prevent, is
because
so the city can't put restrictions on what comes and goes out of that port.
As the city of Oakland did. Could Salt Lake City's Northwest Quadrant become an export point for coal?
Theoretically, you could ship pretty much anything in and out of there. You know, they have big plans for this thing, you know, and whether it takes off or not is remains to be seen. It will create, and this is something that I don't think people are really paying much attention to, but if you are creating a lot of rail traffic, a lot of truck traffic in that, diesel traffic in that area, it's going to aggravate the already problematic air quality issues we have here. But they like the idea that, you know, truckers now can drive 10 hours. And if you can drive 10 hours from Salt Lake City, you can get to pretty much most of the western United States in one day. And so they like the idea of that being sort of a centralized hub for shipping. Although, you know, within 5-10 years, we may not have truckers anymore who are limited to driving 10 hours because it's all going to be self-driving. So it is a little bit of a throwback concept, right? Because, you know, we used to have these great port cities, you know, Long Beach, Oakland, Chicago. I'm not sure that that's the way it's going to work in the future.
I know the governor has been getting an earful on this as well from Salt Lake City residents. I saw this in the Tribune, and we'll see what happens there. But if, as he does, as you say, he does, he intends to sign the bill, what would be the city's next move? Is that, I mean, just keep negotiating, trying to find...
Really, all they can do is keep negotiating. I think there have been some people who've asked about litigation, but the way the Constitution, the way the statutes are set up, the cities are subordinate to the state. in a way that, you know, even maybe counties wouldn't be. So their argument that they would have to make in a lawsuit, I think, would be pretty weak. But yeah, they're going to keep negotiating. And I, you know, we talked a little bit about the special session for gun legislation.
Right.
It's something that maybe if they could come to an agreement could be worked out in a special session within the next few months.
And a new bill.
And a new bill.
Guys, we've run out of time, and I wanted to talk about Representative Chris Stewart, who, as a member of the House Intelligence Committee, has made some media appearances this week critiquing the CIA intelligence communities. Maybe we will save that for another time or for your underplayed story of the week, Robert Gierke, which we have to turn to right now. Final segment of the show. You get to take your pick, Robert.
Yeah, all right. Well, you seem to want me to talk about Chris Stewart. So the House Intelligence Committee has wrapped up its investigation into Russia's meddling with the 2016 election. They said there is no evidence that there was any collusion with the Trump campaign and the Russians, although they didn't get to interview any of the four Trump campaign staffers who are now currently under indictment. Chris Stewart made some headlines, was on CNN and in other programs saying the CIA just got it wrong when they said that the Russians wanted to help Trump and hurt Clinton. And you know, he says he's looked at the data. I mean, it sort of seems like a pretty shameless political twisting of the information. And even some of Stewart's fellow committee members have backed away from that. Trey Gowdy, who was notably led the Benghazi investigation for a number of years, has said that, you know, it's pretty clear that, you know, if you want to hurt Clinton, which they said they wanted to do, then you're obviously helping Trump if it's a two-person race. So Chris Stewart has drawn a little fire for this, as he should, I think, because he is, now becoming the top Trump shill in the House Intelligence Committee.
You can read Robert Gierke's column on that at sltrip.com. Ben Wood, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, our colleague Courtney Danner had an article in today's paper about two panels at BYU led by LGBTQ students at BYU, and just sharing their experiences and kind of doing a Q&A session. But what's notable there is a few years back, BYU notably expelled an LGBT club from campus. And since then, there has been no formal group. The BYU students have been meeting off campus, often at the Provo Library. It's a group called Understanding Same-Sex Attraction. So for BYU to sanction this event yesterday was a bit of a step that a lot of people have been pushing for, and some, I think, were not expecting to happen so quickly. So an interesting article Courtney had just about the discussion happening on campus yesterday.
All right, an unexpected bit of news there. Lee Davidson, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I'll go with a cute story. Not all that important, but in House District 8, Representative Gage Frohr is retiring. He's a Republican. And yesterday, at the filing deadline, an interesting Democrat filed to try to take that seat back for Democrats. It's his sister-in-law, Deanna Frohr. She's run for the state Senate up there before and lost. And she mentioned that because of their opposing politics, it's led to some interesting dinners, you know, with Gage Frohr. She's running against four Republicans, so I don't know what her chances are, but it's just interesting.
It is interesting. It'll make for a weird Thanksgiving conversation for that family, I guess. For my pick, I will go with it's Spring Pledge Drive here at KCPW, so, you know, support the station. Don't forget. Also, 40th anniversary of the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Salt Lake City. I've been marching in it every year of my life that I've lived in Salt Lake City. 40 years of Roger and 40 years of St. Patrick's Day as well. So maybe I'll see you at the parade tomorrow. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Many thanks to all of the guests from the Salt Lake Tribune who are here today, Lee Davidson, Robert Gierke, and Ben Wood. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Happy St. Patrick's.
Also, thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW for his part in the show, to our partners at Utah Public Radio in Logan, including Tom Williams, Alyssa Roberts, and Spencer Holsey, and to the show's producer, Emily Means. Check out her show In the Hive this coming week, an interview with Jackie Biskupski about the inland port that we talked about on this show. If you want to find podcasts of this program, search Behind the Headlines in your podcast app. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in. We will see you next week.